Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Schmidt-Nevin, clinical psychologist and child and adolescent psychotherapist. Welcome to Talking Child Development, the podcast of the Association of Child and Family Development in Melbourne, Australia. The association is a not-for-profit organization that aims to disseminate information on all aspects of child and family development to other professionals and the wider community. In these podcasts, we acknowledge the complexity of the world we live in and its impact on children, adolescents, and their families. We try to avoid a focus that's purely behavioral and quick fix-based, to delve more deeply into issues and ask questions about why things happen to children and families the way they do. You can find more information on our website, www.acfd.com.au, where you'll also be able to access the references mentioned in this podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. John Gherardini, who is a child psychiatrist and head of the Critical and Ethical Mental Health Research Group within the Robinson Research Institute at the University of Adelaide. The aim of the research group is to promote safer and more effective and ethical research and practice in mental health. Dr. Gherardini also heads the Pediatric Mental Health Training Unit, which provides non-pathologizing approaches to primary care mental health, and he is head of psychological medicine at the Women's and Children's Hospital in Adelaide. Welcome, John. I am so looking forward to hearing about your innovative professional work in the field of mental health and psychiatry. You bring a much-needed critical perspective to the increasing pathologizing of all things emotional in our world. Can we start with the Critical Psychiatry Network of Australasia, which I gather is based on the UK group? Can you tell us about the aims of the group and its findings?
Yes, the critical psychiatry. First of all, thank you very much for having me. And thank you for pointing to the complexity of the problems that we all face in therapeutic endeavors, which is something that I feel is in danger of being completely lost. People are looking for simplistic biological or behavioral solutions to what are very complex sets of circumstances. So I think we share a recognition of the importance of complexity in the work that we do. And I suppose the Critical Psychiatry Network, which began and has been very strong in the UK, takes a similar perspective. It criticizes psychiatry's oversimplification of problems. It's over its reification of diagnosis and its bias towards biological treatments. And relatively recently, we've established a similar organisation in Australia, really aimed at, we're not an anti-psychiatry movement, we're antagonistic towards many of the things that are done in the name of psychiatry, but we recognize that there are many people, sadly, who do require specific skilled psychiatric intervention. And we want that intervention to be focused on the people who most need it and to be conducted with dignity and respect for human rights. Which is sadly not always the case.
I would very much agree with that. I mean, one of the things you mentioned with respect to current diagnoses of depression and anxiety is that these tend to be descriptions masquerading as explanations. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, so there we're stealing from a statement that's attributed to psychiatrist Aubrey Lewis, who made that claim in relation to dissociation. But so much of the labeling in psychiatry purports to be explanatory. For example, the depression is an illness like any other, and it's caused by a chemical imbalance, has been rhetoric for years, which is now strongly refuted. So depression is not a bad description of a pattern of behavior and experience that many people share for varying periods of their life and with varying intensity. But it tells us nothing about why the person's having that experience. We always must go looking for what underpins that depression. And most often we can find an explanation, whether it's in terms of interpersonal relationships or grief or disappointment with life or a physical illness. There are as many different explanations as there are people presenting with depression, and we've got to find each person's unique explanation. And when we don't immediately find an explanation, which is often the case, we need to tolerate that uncertainty. We need to do things that are likely to be beneficial for the person without rushing to immediately kind of remove the experience for the person. So what we're doing when we give antidepressants is numbing the emotional distress that the person's experiencing. And if we do that as our first line of intervention, then there's a danger that we're going to, apart from all of the possible harms and likely lack of benefit of that intervention, we're also likely to mask what's going on, distract both ourselves and the patient from any further search for what might be an explanation for their experience, and generally obstruct the possibility of some kind of benefit coming from going through the experience of depression and understanding why I've become depressed, and as a result, becoming stronger, rather than just having the pain taken away with the medication.
I mean, I so totally agree with that. I mean, one of the things that I've written about in my various writings about child development is that anxiety and depression are two emotions that require to be negotiated by children, by parents. They are the two key sort of emotional experiences. I'm not necessarily talking about clinical, high-level clinical anxiety and depression, where people literally can't get out of their beds. But life has challenges. Disappointment is part of life. And anxiety sometimes is a necessary experience. You need to feel anxious or motivated enough to move from one stage of development to the next. You know, we can't rule these things out. And so in a way, children need to be able to develop internal resources to be able to manage these experiences rather than to see them as pathologies or sort of entities that float around that have to be removed. And that I
Yes,
think
but I think it's really important to qualify that statement, with which I agree, with the fact that neither of us are being dismissive of the very real distress that people are experiencing when they come to see us. And often I think depression and anxiety as clinical presentations, whether you call them disorders or not, they need to be decoded in some way, broken down. I mean, most often when I see somebody depressed, it's because they're pushing away other feelings, sadness, anger, shame, and or avoiding thinking about things that are intolerable to think about, like my mum and dad hate each other, or I'm never going to be the person that my family want me to be. And so it's not, and I know you weren't saying this, but it's not just a matter of saying these are normal feelings, just get over it or just tolerate it. A lot of the people we see who get labeled with labels that you and I would disagree with, nevertheless, are very significantly distressed, and there are things wrong in their life or their life circumstances that do need to be addressed and challenged.
absolutely. I think what we're really talking about is that behavior has a meaning. It's not random.
Exactly.
always has a meaning, and all behavior has a meaning, all emotion has a meaning, and we want to dignify the behavior, as you were saying, with recognizing its complexity and its deeper meaning. Just going on to looking at the issues of prescriptions for antidepressants, I looked up a few statistics recently, and in the UK, for the years 2022 to 2023, there were 86 million prescriptions dispensed to an estimated 8.6 million people. In Australia, one in seven people is prescribed antidepressants. And over the slightly earlier period, 2021 to 2022, there were 3.5 million prescriptions dispensed. And I think you've mentioned this, or you've touched on this just a moment earlier, that there's a general belief in the population that antidepressant drugs provide a treatment and that they restore a kind of chemical imbalance. So my understanding is that these psychotropic drugs largely have a sedating effect. But can you tell us a bit more about how they work and their longer standing effects, and do they really refer to a chemical imbalance?
No, there's absolutely no evidence, nor has there ever been, that depression is associated with a chemical imbalance. I mean, it was the rhetoric about chemical imbalance was really drug marketing. The reasoning being, we give a drug that increases certain neurotransmitters, people feel better as a result of that. Therefore, they must have had a defect that's been corrected by this increase in neurotransmitter. But that's like saying, I'm socially anxious. If I have a couple of drinks, I become less socially anxious and better company. Therefore, I was suffering from an alcohol imbalance. It's a vaguely plausible but completely unscientific argument. So, antidepressants have, so far as we can tell, no specific effect on somebody who has depression, but they do have an emotional numbing effect, and that might be welcome to somebody who's feeling overwhelming negative and distressing emotions. So, if there is a place for antidepressants, then it's guided by what Joanna Moncrief, the British psychiatrist, has termed drug-centered prescribing, which she contrasts disease-centered prescribing. So, disease-centered prescribing would be, I've made a diagnosis of depression, this is the drug that's going to treat the depression. Drug-centered prescribing would be, this person has a range of discomforts and symptoms. I have a drug that may reverse some of those symptoms. In this particular case, I think the benefits outweigh the harms. Therefore, more or less as a kind of clinical trial of one person, I'm going to initiate a medication. I'm going to watch very carefully to ensure that the benefits do outweigh the harms. And if they do, the medication should continue. If they don't, then the medication should cease. And if all prescribing was done like that, then we would have only a fraction of the prescribing that's currently carried out, and it would be much safer and more productive.
Absolutely. I mean, we'll talk about that a bit later with respect to general practitioners who I think are responsible for most of these prescriptions. But it's interesting that the dates of the statistics I've just mentioned with respect to the prescribing of antidepressants and coincide with the height of the COVID pandemic, when governments at both federal and state level struggled to cope with huge uncertainty about the physical risk and its aftermath. But it seemed that perhaps to many of us working in mental health, that very little attention was paid to the emotional impact on generations of children and young people and their parents, as well as individual adults. And I wonder what your views are about how the pandemic may have shaped attitudes towards and indeed intolerance for depression and anxiety.
So maybe if I can first look at about mental health problems, individual, that as a sort of first line assumption, when somebody presents with symptoms of anxiety or depression or ADHD or whatever it is, that that's more likely to represent something interpersonal than it is something about that individual. And that makes social animals, and our health is predicated on what's happening in our immediate interpersonal environment and the broader culture in which we live. So COVID was an interrupter of social discourse. For some of us who are well off and lived in comfortable circumstances and had any isolation experiences occurring in the context of a supportive family environment, then there was no harm done psychologically by COVID, apart from the fear of what the outcomes might be or the grief associated with the loss of loved ones. But we were protected by our social interactions. For people, and not only those living in relative poverty, but overrepresented amongst the poorer segments of the population, COVID was associated with increased isolation, loss of social support. And because our culture works the way it does, rather than that as an emergency which needs to be responded to with strengthening of social networks and making sure that people, when they came out of isolation, were subject to an enriched social environment, we medicalize the problem and want to give therapy and treatment to people. Sure, there were some people damaged during the process and tipped over into you know, what constituted something that did need individual therapeutic responses. But our position as a society in Australia is to recognise distress as being a medical problem, but it also provided an illustration of how wrong we are as a society in the way we approach disaster or potential disaster that COVID presented us with.
I would tend to agree with that. But I also wonder whether there really was very little attention paid to those issues in a general sense.
Certainly priority was, the calculus that was done was all around saving lives rather than recognising or taking into account the cost to people's relationships and well-being. And part of that was, I think is directly attributable to the medicalized approach we have to distress and suffering, that because of COVID, we'll need more mental health resources, other than our approach to COVID needs to take account of the social damage that's being done by the various interventions. It doesn't mean the interventions were wrong, but it does mean that when people were weighing up and making decisions about it, they should have been taking more account of the psychological damage that could be done by the restrictiveness that was seemed to be required by the, the life-saving measures that were perceived.
Yes, yes. I mean, this sort of links with the fact that for many years you've rightly emphasized the social determinants of mental illness, such as lack of housing, lack of opportunity, family violence, and a myriad other social issues. And we're in total agreement about the danger in current times of locating the problem in the individual and not in society. Can you tell us a bit more about this, or what do you think needs to change in order for us to refocus our understanding about this?
Well, I think we need to change change our view of what constitutes a mental health intervention. And so the most powerful mental health interventions are interventions that increase social capital in communities. If we address poverty and inequality, if we make sure that people have secure housing, if we don't have people either trapped in unemployment or in the gig economy, then, you know, things like drug and alcohol use, criminality, mental health presentations will all be reduced. And so, and for children, we undervalue the main protective institution apart from the family, which is the school or early childhood education and care. And there's very good evidence that that children who've experienced adversity but have good experience at school are protected from some of the worst mental health outcomes as a result of that. But we underpay and undervalue teachers. We put little resources into public schools at the expense of privileged private schools, and too little investment in education overall. If you ask me where we should invest to include and to improve children's mental health, that's where we should do it, in education. And it's not the case, as some people promote the idea, that schools are settings in which it's possible to detect mental health problems early and then refer them off or have them addressed. That's not what schools are for. Schools are for providing good emotional and cognitive experiences for children, the same things that build imagination and conceptual skills. They build emotional strength as well. And so it's not the case that having more people like me trained and supported and well paid is where the investment should be made. I think it needs to be made at the more fundamental level of improving society, helping schools to be stronger. But the problem is that you need much bigger thinking and much bigger budgets to intervene at that level. And so you can double the budget for child and adolescent mental health services for a fraction of the amount that you need to make a significant increase in the resources available to schools, because there are, you know, so few of us to start with. And so it's attractive to politicians when people lobby them for increasing conventional child and adolescent mental health services to think that that's the kind of solution that's needed. But I think, you know, most of the time, what we're doing is creating more well-paid positions for relatively privileged people without doing anything about the living circumstances of the constituency that makes up most of the business of child and adolescent mental health services.
I completely agree with what you're saying. You see, the two things come to mind. One is that in the school system, which, and I so agree, I have to say, I have never been able to understand how so much money can go into private school education and so little goes into a public school education. So you have people and children in private school living in sort of having grand well-being centres and having sort of penthouse type accommodation, and public schools having sort of horrendous temporary buildings that are half a century old, you know, that should absolutely, they have a blot on the landscape. And the thing that worries me about that is there's a sort of culture that's been spawned about teaching children resilience. And I'm very suspicious of that. I don't think we should teach children to be resilient in the context of a deprived environment. I think we should teach them to be mindful and critical of that. And so everyone is having to put up with stuff that shouldn't be put up with. And the other thing is, I sometimes wonder whether, is it just about money or is it also about attitudes? I'm not convinced that it's that you have to pour huge amounts of money into the school system, but I think you have to have reasonable parity. And if you have to take it out of one place that's getting too much and putting it into the other, that seems to be a not unreasonable suggestion.
I think there also needs to be much more respect for teachers, you know, in it needs to be a much more valued profession. It's too easy, too uncompetitive to become a teacher. It's like it should be, teachers should be in status up there with, you know, doctors and lawyers and you know, a country, there are countries, Scandinavian countries, I think, where you know, that's highly competitive to become a teacher. And you know, we live in a country where you need higher marks to study commerce than you do to become a teacher. That feels to be the wrong way around to me.
Absolutely. Yes, I think we have to value our educators, and but I also think we have to rethink the rethink schools. But that's a whole other topic. But just talking about children, you've spoken and about and written most eloquently about the pathologizing of normal emotions, particularly in children, and you've described that when children and young people are angry, ashamed, frightened, sad, and disappointed, there's a tendency to see these emotions not as part of normal growing up, but as potential precursors of disease. And there's a quote, I'm just quoting you, where you say parents, doctors, and teachers are prone to label and intervene rather than sit with ordinary, healthy, but distressing feelings. And I wonder, how can we change this type of rigid discourse that's not in the best interests of children and young people?
I think we can just try to represent a different point of view. I mean, I think what over the last decade or so, we've seen an incredible rise of social influence through social media of non-professional people leading the discussion. So it's no longer the case that the key opinion leaders have the stage to themselves in terms of defining what should have a medical response and what's normal. And at the moment, the dominant discourse, particularly perhaps around ADHD and adult ADHD in particular, is a broader and broader definition of, or a broader and broader church for people to belong to. I harbour a fantasy that there's going to be a backlash against that, and that people with who are participating in these social media conversations will increasingly raise skeptical points of view about the dismissal of ordinary healthy feelings. We're beginning to see some discourse. It's too much outweighed by the medicalized discourse, but we're beginning to see people listen to who speak about how disappointed they are that their experience was treated as a medical problem rather than their feelings being respected.
I think that's right. I mean, the other factor is that what people may not realize is that this, once you have a diagnosis, this goes onto your medical record and stays on your medical record for life. And the notion that these records are absolutely confidential and no one will ever see them is unfortunately something that we now know is not possible because of people breaking into various systems. Now, that means that future employers, insurance companies, may have access to that kind of information. And so, someone who's desperately keen, for instance, for an ADHD diagnosis, may find that there are certain jobs for which they may no longer be able to qualify. I mean, I find it puzzling that people don't understand the full, the future implications, both for themselves as adults, but also for children.
I don't think there's enough analysis done of the harms and benefits of buying a label. So people are embracing labels like ADHD or autism spectrum disorder because they feel like that offers them an explanation for difficulties that they've had. And as I've said, these are not explanatory labels, but they're marketed as explanatory labels. So people are told that, convinced that being described as neurodiverse, for example, imparts some meaning to their experience, but it's a completely meaningless term. It's kind of like fast food, I suppose. It's got an effect of immediate gratification, but down the track it may have harms that people haven't anticipated. And so that really worries me that people are being falsely marketed benefits from labels without being properly informed of the potential harms.
Absolutely. And how does this link, do you think, with children and young people currently and proudly self-diagnosing themselves with mental health problems, almost as a badge of honor? You know, they have an exchange. Oh, what label do you have? You know, they're keen to have a psychiatric, a label about connected with psychiatric disturbance. How has that ever come about? And
well, I think it's about, a lot of it, I think, is about does it provide agency? Like, I think people like you and me would think that attributing your life difficulties to a psychiatric label robs you of agency. But I think from the perspective of a lot of these young people, they feel a greater sense of agency because they now found people who feel to be like me. It's an identity thing. And they feel that they don't have to go looking for an understanding of why things are the way they are in their life. They've been given an off-the-shelf explanation. And in terms of its immediate effects, it doesn't really seem to matter whether or not the explanation is actually scientifically plausible or ethically acceptable or all of those things that we would worry about. It just solves an immediate problem. Again, a bit like fast food. It's, you know, flavoursome and immediately gratifying, but you've got to think through the longer-term consequences.
See, I wonder also whether we've let children and young people down, you know, whether it's not just that they want fast food and they don't want to hear about anything more complicated or take those steps. But I wonder whether, in fact, we, parents, schools, society, we let them down. You know, I think about schoolies, for instance. I mean, that may seem a bit of a diversion, but, you know, children, young people desperately want a marker for the end of school. And the schoolies experience is really a travesty, I mean, of what they want a sense of moving into adulthood. And what we're offering them is pretty rubbish. It's sort of a rubbishy commercial, horrible experience with a lot of risk attached. We need to do better. I mean, I think we all need to do better for children and young people. And I think that perhaps what they see is that there's not enough around. That, you know, maybe they turn to their parents. Their parents aren't able to kind of find out how they can help and support them. And so they rush to these descriptions.
But like fast food, it's also very, very intensively marketed. Whether it's deliberate marketing or whether it's people, you know, operating out of a kind of conspiracy of goodwill, people are doing what they think is the right thing. But, you know, and risk aversion is a really big part of it, that we adults, whether in parental roles or professional roles, want things to be okay. We don't want our children to experience distress, and we particularly are frightened by the prospect of them killing themselves or becoming drug addicts or something like that. And so We don't tolerate their distress, and we don't respect their distress, and we don't respect their capacity to survive their distress. And so, you know, the whole concept of watchful waiting, whether in a medical setting or in a parental setting, is devalued. It's kind of when you put forward the idea of watchful waiting, it's dismissed as doing nothing. You need to do something, not just wait. But actually, just waiting is incredibly powerful and important, provided you communicate to the young person that you're there with them and recognizing their distress, not being dismissive of it, but respectful of their capacity to overcome the circumstances, or their ally in changing things if things need to be changed. And, you know, that Alcoholics Anonymous Serenity Prayer, I think, has a lot of wisdom in it. I can't remember the exact wording of it, but you've got to change the things that can be changed, and you've got to accept the things that can't be changed. And working with our young people to do those two things, or which of those, working out which of those two things is required, and supporting them through that process rather than labeling them or medicating them or both.
Absolutely. I mean, it's as though there's a kind of lack of containment, isn't there?
Mm.
There's a tendency towards a lack of containment in the adult world. And then, as you say, people, and particularly parents, get very, very anxious. You know, I was just thinking of so many parents have said to me over the years, I just want my child to be happy.
Yeah.
I kind of feel that seems a big ask, you know, but also, is that really what you want? Is that what we want for children, that they have to be happy? And I would tend to think maybe if we could suggest that they could be contented, that contentment
Yeah.
could be in there. But the idea of happiness is that's quite a difficult one.
Yeah, so my version of that has always been, it's much more important to be good at feelings than to feel good.
Yes, that's a good one. Very good. So the other thing I just wondered about is, where do the professionals come into all of this? So starting with a general practitioner, they do a wonderful job under pressure, but there's a strong sense that increasingly they have to give patients what they want. They're not allowed to take a step back and use a kind of watch and wait, or patients will get very annoyed with them, or simply go doctor shopping and get a prescription somewhere else. And the other thing I have to say, with great respect to GPs, is they seem not to have a lot of understanding about emotional, psychological, really, they don't seem to have enough training in that area, when so many people present to them precisely with those sorts of problems.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very complex thing. First of all, we dump all of the work that we can't do onto GPs and expect them to be, well, the GPs are very strongly influenced by the pharmaceutical industry to see medications as the solution to people's problems. If you've only got a limited amount of time, you're feeling under pressure, it's probably best not to, for survival, best not to recognize too much about the emotional and social nature of people's problems and to oversimplify them. So a good GP will fight against that. There are some cynical GPs who just want the patient in and out as quickly as possible. The majority of GPs in the middle are under pressure to behave more like the bad GPs than the good GPs because of the systemic constraints and influences on them. So it's not just that GPs lack training. I mean, you know, the knowledge base required to develop the kinds of attitudes that we would want GPs to have are imparted in amongst all the other stuff. during medical school. So it's all there available for doctors, but there are all kinds of forces pushing people away from that kind of attitude. There are bad GPs, just like there are bad people in any other profession, but there are lots of good GPs who are not conducting the kind of practice that we would want them to, because of systemic pressures and misinformation. And it's not as simple as just imparting better information, although that's part of it.
It's a pity, really, because they're the first port of call, really, for everyone. And I mean, I think they need support and, well, really better training.
There is evidence, I believe, that jurisdictions in which there are more GPs and less specialists have better health outcomes than those who have more specialists and less GPs.
Really?
So GPs are still doing a lot of things right.
Yes.
But at the same time, they prescribe something like 85% of all antidepressants, and the vast majority of those people shouldn't be on those medications.
I think this is the point at which they feel constrained and feel they have to do it. They have to give the patient what they want, as opposed to perhaps using their discretion and their understanding, really. In relation to that, there were two interesting articles in the press recently. One was about the need to distinguish everyday stress and anxiety from mental illness, and the other was about the experience of the writer and poet Sandy Jeffs, who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. Both of these articles describe how the mental health publicity machine, including the use of celebrities to destigmatize depression and anxiety and the loosening of diagnostic criteria, paradoxically leads to the stresses of everyday life becoming pathologized and overpublicized, while the services for the seriously mentally ill remain on life support in the shadows. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, well, I think the absolute priority of psychiatry as a profession should be to ensure that people with severe disorders are treated with dignity and respect, and get all of the support and care that they need, which is not the case. That we would want to think that if there's an alternative to psychiatric care for an individual, then we should pursue that wherever possible. Not ever expand the percentage of the population that are regarded as candidates for psychiatric care, but actually be saying what's the fewest number of people we can deal with, and let's offer them a really good service. And that's not to deny the distress or suffering of other people, but let's try and find different, more creative ways that build social capital in responding to that broader level of distress.
Yes, I think that that's also very sort of celebrity focused. And Sandy Jeffs writes about the terror and horror of the public hospital psychiatric wards, and she says, where the carpets end and the linoleum begins, which is a shocking indictment of that is actually what she's talking about, you know. And she says of the PR machine, where is the celebrity living with schizophrenia? You know, we've got footballers or whoever, politicians saying, oh, I got very depressed and, oh, I had, you know, whatever. But actually, I mean, obviously people are terrified of serious mental illness. And perhaps that has a lot to do with the way in which we think about it and also treat it.
The evidence is pretty strong that listening to people who've been through the experience and having them guide the therapeutic responses that are offered is central to having a humanistic response to severe mental illness.
I think that's right. And how do we do that? I think Sandy Jeffs writes about that as well and said that in order to begin to be the patient influencing the system, that becomes a highly complicated process. And she ended up saying she didn't think she would be able to qualify for that. So there are ways in which that also has to be thought about. And then finally, I know this is a huge question. Do we need to have a different and more truthful conversation about mental health and about this terribly overused term well-being? And what it constitutes mental illness to help people understand that life itself is not psychopathology and has its inevitable ups and downs? And I mean, these are such huge questions. How can we move away from the world of influences? And what role do we as professionals have? I mean, if we don't want the influences to be dominating, then we have to do something different as professionals. And what do we need to do? And how do we need to try and influence the discourse?
I think there needs to be good information available for people who want to enter into the debate about the pros and cons of medicalizing ordinary human experience or human suffering. It's a bit like saying, what can we do about capitalism? Possibly very little, because the people who have the real power are never going to willingly give it up. This may sound overly pessimistic, but I think all we can do is try to keep a flame burning for a different approach to the human experience, one that is not risk averse, is respectful of strong and negative feelings, recognizes that people can grow through adversity, but not in the kind of dismissive idea of you need to be resilient, but rather by increasing connectedness, keep pushing the idea that we need social change. I mean, if we could achieve the level of social change that would reduce social inequity and poverty and those kinds of things, then I think that a lot of the mental illness discourse would disappear. Because people would be leading better lives and would have less recourse to labelling and medicating and those kind of things. So, yeah, maybe we need a revolution. I don't know.
Maybe a mini one. But I was just wondering, with respect to your ethical mental health research group, do you feel that that's expanding? That other psychiatrists are beginning to be interested in that approach?
I think, one of the things that's happened relatively recently is that the system has been forced to recognize that there are many people, have very serious problems withdrawing from antidepressant drugs. And it's really the first note of caution about the kind of medicalized psychiatric enterprise that's got serious traction. And that may be the beginning of a shift in the complacency about the medicalized approach to distress. So that's one thing that gives me a little bit of optimism.
Yes, yes. So I suppose we have to start modestly and move on from there. But
yeah.
Thank you so much, John. I think that is really fantastic to speak to you and to be able to talk about these very important issues. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Dr. Ruth Schmidt-Nevin again. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. You may be interested to know about my audio trainings based on the many trainings I have run throughout Australia and overseas. These include training on relationships, attachment, and the brain, time-limited psychodynamic psychotherapy, and skill building in therapeutic work. You can access the details of all my trainings on my website, which is at www.centerforchildandfamily.com. That's A-N-D, so www.centerforchildandfamily.com. Thank you.